reminding a child, you might have done something unkind, but that doesn't mean you're unkind. And us reassuring them that they're a good person isn't enabling bad behavior. It's actually setting them up to be more confident in themselves. So believe in them beyond the behavior. Believe in them more than they believe in themselves.
Family life is essential. Jim and I are on a mission to help you live the best one. You'll hear personal stories from thought leaders of strengths and struggles with proven strategies to help you make the most of your 18 summers. I'm your co-host, Jamie Shields.
18 summers. Please welcome Andy Martineau. We're going to be speaking with her today on how to get your children to listen through connection. Imagine that. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I love talking about parenting. I love what you guys are doing, blending work and family and making it all work. It's beautiful. So thanks for leading this conversation out.
I think what got my most attention when we started reviewing and researching you was the Reformed Yeller. So when you said that, I know that's something of great interest probably to the whole community of what is a Reformed Yeller and how do we all become one?
Oh my gosh.
I'm not much of a yeller.
It's usually like goofy yelling.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. I mean, Reformed Yeller is not a title I wanted to really own. I would rather say never have yelled. Yeah, it's so many kids. It's 6 kids in 8 years. And so it really gave me this perfect storm to learn how to control my nervous system. So learning how to go from getting frustrated and being frazzled all of the time with my kids to not yelling really started with this. I couldn't explain it. I didn't deserve it, but I had been busy. I had 5 kids at the time and I realized it had been about 30 minutes. I'd been killing it, doing the laundry, feeling like I'm going to accomplish something today. And then I realized how quiet it was. So I started looking for the toddlers that were somewhere in my house that couldn't be accounted for. Yeah, I sneaked into the playroom, which was a 2-car converted garage. And so it just had the doorway, like the entrance of a regular door. So I had to be very sneaky to peek in to try not to disturb them in their play. And I realized they had grabbed the Costco size bottle of baby powder and just doused the whole thing. My daughter's like, there was flour too. We talk about it now. I said, oh my gosh, I just remembered the baby powder whiff coming out and I lost it. I had this moment. It was pretty typical, but I lost it. I was tired. I had a newborn. I was just tired. And I went in and started doing all the corrective stuff, lecture, consequence, just really, really frustrated. And I saw my about 3 or 4 at the time, gaze go from happy, look at this creation we made, to just distraught and destroyed. And I was able to pause in that moment and calm myself down. I didn't know what I was doing, but I calmed myself down. I went from super heightened emotionally, really triggered nervous system to being able to enjoy just the parenting moment and see the goodness in my kid instead of what they had been doing to work against me. And that moment led me to really be determined to figure out how to be like that every time. I had kind of gotten lazy and tired and just thought, I have 5 kids. And at the time, having 1 more year later than that, so added to the bunch and had 6 at the time, 5. And I was just exhausted. And I thought, this is the best I can do. I've tried everything. I'll keep trying everything. And that set me on a trajectory to figure out, I don't ever want to yell. I mean, I'm probably going to yell again. I'm probably going to lose my patience, but my goal is to not yell. And it was already my goal, but I had seen in that moment that it was possible to calm myself down even when I was super escalated. And yeah, it set me off to say like, okay, how did I do that? I reverse engineer it. It took me a couple years to figure it out. What's the science behind it? Because my degree is in nursing and I need science and data to prove it. I didn't want to be a passive parent. And I was afraid if I stopped yelling that, not that I needed to yell, but if I stopped using corrective forms of parenting, discipline and consequences, and that the kids would just go crazy. So ultimately started to find developmental psychology and neuroscience and all of these things that really fed into me forming a way of understanding my mind and calming my nervous system down and learning how to control myself better. Really looking at, oh, it starts with me. Oh, shoot. I thought it was about fixing the kids. I better do some internal work on myself and get my stuff together. So that's the journey that led me to really not give up on the process of figuring it out, seeing it's possible, figuring out the steps. And yeah, just being focused on it. It became my full-time job, really my full-time focus. So
Awesome.
Yeah.
A lot of times when people hire us to coach them as parents, they want us to fix their children. And then we can't help you because it's
right. Yeah. It's not about that.
And it's so difficult because as you even just said now, as you were talking in the moment, your children were doing to work against you. And so like you had such a perspective, like these tiny humans have gathered together in a mutiny against me.
Why? What it felt like.
And I get that. And I think so many parents get that, but it's just not about you. And I think that's like the greatest answer and the most difficult answer, right? Like you can't, it's
I used to believe in that conspiracy because when you're tired and you're,
or you're like,
they did that on purpose. So they were planning that, and you step back and look at the absurdity. But in the moment, it's tough, as you said, especially when you start to stack multiples and multiples. And just that amazing point of awareness, if you can catch yourself.
Intentionality.
Yeah. How do you help people catch themselves?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first part is really understanding what's going on. I think we brought up a great point, realizing, okay, when I'm in my highest thinking, I realize the kids aren't trying to form a mutiny against me. So that's a great step. But also, what are the stories I have around my kids' behavior? A lot of us, the parents, just inadvertently find a lot of our success. We find validation by how well or how not great our kids are doing. And so I can't get my validation or my worth out of my kids' behavior. My success as a parent has nothing to do with their behavior. It has to do everything with my behavior. And so understanding my own mind, my own behavior, what's causing my emotions that are fueling my actions, that's one of the first steps that is critical for them to be able to see, why is this my reality? If I think my kids are rude, and so then I feel frustrated, when I talk to them about their behavior, it's going to be flavored with that tone and that emotion and that judgment. And the mirror neurons in my brain are going to be sending out that signal, and they're going to be picking up on it. Our kids can map really beautifully and much better. We want to admit we can be smiling, but still have frustration in us. And they pick up on the frustration. They see right past the smile. So we can't fake it. And so understanding that and looking at ourselves first is critical to being able to show up differently with our kids and interrupt the pattern and shift the way we are being with them.
And do you have a best-selling book, The Connect Parenting Method, or Connect Method Parenting? Forgive
me. Yeah. No, you're good.
In there, can you give us like tactical steps that you teach in your book to help acknowledge and like start to move toward that better way, that more connective way?
That more connective way. Yeah. I talk about a lot of things in the book, but two things that apply to what you're asking. One, I call STEAR, and it's an acronym, STEAR. I do know it's spelled wrong. You got to love acronyms, right? But it's a framework for really doing what we were just talking about, doing really understanding my own mind. So the S is the situation. And I have parents really get clear and take away all the adjectives by just putting the facts of the situation. So often we want to say the kids were messy, or they were rude, or they were frustrated. But if we can't get a group of 100 people to all agree that this is rude behavior, then we need to just take that away and say that what they said or what the room looked like. And so we really try to neutralize what's happening to get all the drama out of it, because our brains are meaning making machines. And so we got to stop that. So that would be step one. And then reflecting back on a situation, and we have that clearly defined now. What is the situation? The bedroom had 20 items on the floor. Then what was my thought about it? And so this allows a parent to really understand the story they have. The kids are messy. They're lazy. They're never going to figure out how to take care of themselves. And then the emotion that comes as a result of that belief. And everyone's belief is different. That's why it's super great to be very specific. Our brain wants to be very general and do these sweeping overgeneralizations. And that doesn't allow our subconscious brain to really go in and create new neural pathways. We've got to get specific. Mm-hmm. So that emotion, if it's frustration or resentment, that makes a difference. The parent needs to know, is it irritation or frustration or resentment or exhaustion? because whatever that emotion is, it fuels our action. I like to think of it like salt. It just flavors all of the stuff that comes after. And so if that's the fuel to my actions, I want that to be clean fuel. Just like a car, I wouldn't want to put dirty fuel into a car. It's going to affect the way it runs. The emotions are going to affect the way my actions are received, the way that my child and I create a relationship after that. And so looking closely at, okay, I was really resentful. Then I go into the actions, which is the A. What did I do? I went and said something. I was snappy. I got just on and on. And then the result, which is the R, helps them really see the life they're creating. And now I can see from point A to point B how I'm creating it. And it takes all the guesswork. It makes it not so messy. And it really creates clarity. So somebody can look at that with curiosity, no judgment. Because if we get judgmental, we're just triggering our own nervous systems again, and we're not going to be able to make good decisions. But if we can look at it like a scientist would just look at a problem they were trying to solve, or a business owner is looking at a problem in their business they're trying to make sense of, then now I can see what is happening and what I want to create. And so we move them through from a, I call it an unintentional steer to an intentional steer. And that's really helpful to understand what's actually happening, because sometimes we just get so stuck in our stories, and those subconscious stories are so powerful and strong, and we've practiced them so many times, they just become our unquestioned truth. And so we have to see that it's an optional story that I could change if I wanted to.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. And we were actually just a family retreat that we do every year in the Keys with a couple of other families, mastermind, and a man named David Zelman. David Zelman presented, he wrote a book, and he may have written a couple of books, but specifically what he talked to us about was the difference between an automatic conversation in your head and an intentional conversation in your head. And what I'm hearing you say is very much our triggers and those STEA are all the stories that are automatic and that we tell ourselves. It's not really the true stories. It's just all the stuff that we bring in, and because we do bring it all in, don't we?
We do bring it all in. And that's exactly the same thing I'm saying, right? Is we have these stories we practice so many times, or because of how we were raised, or because of how society has taught us. So they're just automatic. And our subconscious brain, I was looking at a study and I can't remember the exact numbers, but it processes 10 times more bits, or maybe even more than that, 100 times more bits of data per second than our conscious brain. And so once a story goes subconscious, it's going to run the show. It's a fast speeding train versus a hand cart that we're pumping on the tracks.
And it seems even I feel like I'm always calling you out on this. Feel free to always call me on too. But I feel like to hear that subconscious fires a lot faster makes sense to me, because I have a joke. I'm like, gosh, once it goes in, no matter if it went in wrong, it just sticks. That's the story. And so remember when Michael fell and you're like, gosh, mom, how's Michael doing? I'm like, remember, not that Michael. He's been through it a couple of times. But again, that's just a small example.
No, like, you're right, though.
Whatever input.
The speed train versus the hand cart is very true.
It's such a great.
So you just have to keep the hand cart going to eventually drown it out. Because a lot of people are going right now, okay, that true, makes sense.
True.
Speed train against the hand cart. How am I ever going to catch up?
Yeah. In real life moments, when that subconscious brain, especially when we're in fight or flight, because then the subconscious brain takes over for survival, that's not the time we're going to override the old neural pathway. It's just going to come in at full speed ahead and take over. So the work really has to be done before or after the moment. So we're preparing ahead of time, just like an athlete would. Someone who's pitching in the major leagues isn't figuring out how to do it in the game. They have put in hours of practice.
Yeah.
And so that they're prepared for the game, but that's not when it ends. After the game, they're watching tapes, they're getting coaching, they're still fixing their pitch. And so that's the same with parenting, really anything. We want to rewrite that neural pathway is we've got to prepare ahead of time. Then we go try it out. We may do great. We may not do great, but either way is fine. We learn from it and we try again. And so that's how we create a new neural pathway. And once that new neural pathway is in place and our brain has enough evidence to support it, it will start to outweigh the old one and become subconscious. It's similar to driving. I have a daughter who got her permit this week. And so every single thing, it's overwhelming and there's so much to think about and you can't quite figure out how to stay in the lane. We're figuring that out. Pretty soon, that's all going to become subconscious. So she's going to be able to do that and talk to people and all of the things that we do while we're driving the car. That's really remarkable because so much of it is on autopilot. So we just want to be more and more intentional to put beliefs that we really like on autopilot. And then we get those habits in place and things just fall into place so much easier.
Things improve.
Yeah.
What do you think about using the same method in other relationships?
Oh, it works in every relationship. I mean, I focused it onto parenting because that is my love and what I love to talk to parents about. But yeah, my husband all of the time, you're using it on the relationship. I'm like, yeah, I am. Not in a manipulative, controlling way, but he's like, oh, this works so well with him, with friends, with in-laws. It's all based in relationship science, right? Like that's where it really comes from. And then it's slightly altered if you're applying it to another adult, because they have a fully formed prefrontal cortex, developed brain, and they're autonomous and they have different capabilities of functioning in their world versus a child of yours that isn't in the same place or has the same autonomy as an adult, but underneath the fundamentals are the same. Yeah.
That's great. Because I know that was a big aha for us when we started using our connection formula and our board meeting strategy.
Yeah.
And with our parents and with our siblings, just became, we were like,
it works everywhere.
It is funny because I think at first, as you said, there's a little pushback, not so much pushback, but that feeling of, oh, you're using your framework on me, or like, oh, just because you say it in a friendly voice or whatever it may be, like you sometimes will be like, oh, just because you Waldorf it doesn't mean you're not pissed underneath or whatever.
I love Waldorf.
I think there's these layers where people like, they know that this is what you're an expert in.
You know? It's a hesitancy and then an appreciation, I think. Vice versa.
Yeah.
With the children, I think sometimes with
things. Oh, sometimes they got your number, huh?
Yeah.
They're
the most challenging of your six. Ooh. What would be your greatest advice to anyone else who has their most challenging?
To meet your child where they are without judgment and to help them really know that there's nothing wrong with them. Our kids, when they're struggling and they're maybe at their worst, they're saying unkind things. Are what society might call rude or disrespectful or any of those things. Our kids know that they're being rude or disrespectful because when their off track behavior is so apparent, that means their nervous system is off track and that feels icky. Plus they just know what's socially okay. They don't want to be unkind, but sometimes their emotions get the worst of them. And so reminding a child, like, yeah, you might have done something unkind, but that doesn't mean you're unkind. You may have said something that was rude, but that doesn't mean you're rude, right? We all do that sometimes. And really reminding them, especially as they're maturing, I want them to have really great thoughts about themselves because teenagers, which is the main phase I'm in right now, but even tweens and toddlers, like you want that internal story to be good. And us reassuring them that they're a good person isn't enabling bad behavior. It's actually setting them up to be more confident in themselves, to be able to look at themselves and really inspect their behavior and make a shift. So you got to meet them where they are and accept them for who they are and believe in them beyond the behavior, believe in them more than they believe in themselves.
Makes a ton of sense.
It does.
Yeah.
What if there's a moment, I'm trying to think of a great example and it's not happening. For example, when you came down and the powder and the flour and everything was everywhere. And I love a great mess. I do also like help when we clean it up.
Yes.
Okay. So initial reaction, whoa, what in the world's going on here?
Yeah.
Then shifting into, oh, okay. They were having fun. They weren't trying to be malicious. We do have a task here now that needs to be handled. And so how do you go from, we had a little baby freak out on the inside, but it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And got this, guys, but let's teamwork it together to get it pulled together. Because the behavior isn't bad, because it is fun, all of those things. How do you communicate, like, but next time, can we do it like this? How do you get to the other side of, like, you're not bad, you're amazing and wonderful, and this is fun. And don't ever do that to me again.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the key is just the relationship. So if I can get through that situation, and get it cleaned up and we can have a fun time. Irate the whole time we're cleaning it up, then they're going to feel that. And in that particular situation, my kids were not very big. They were pretty small. And so the best motivation I had wasn't logic and reason, because they just really can't. Like physiologically, if you study the brain, the prefrontal cortex does not come on until around 7. So these were all pre-7-year-olds. There was no cause and effect, logic and reason in the way us adults have it. And so the main mechanism, I would say across all ages, but especially when they're toddlers and they can't even figure out the logic and reason or even understand the magnitude of the mess, is to just go to the relationship so that they want to choose to follow me. Because ultimately, our kids have to choose us, no matter what age they are. We have the role of a parent. We have the responsibility of a parent, but we don't have the right to parent. That's something we have to earn. Our mm-hmm. children really have to choose us to be their leader, choose us to be the one that they listen to. And that comes from how we create that relationship of trust and safety with them. And so my kids at that age were a lot more likely to listen to my suggestions of, hey, we can't use the baby powder for this kind of activity. But it was them choosing to listen to me because, hey, mom's a safe person. She's got our backs. She understands us. She doesn't get frustrated with us even when we misbehave. I want to listen to her. And to the degree they can do that is questionable at 3, 4, and 5. But if you just keep remembering that that's the foundation of your parenting, if you want to have impact and influence, it's about the relationship, it's about the trust, it's about the safety, then the suggestions we make and the good intentions our kids have are going to eventually become stronger and more reliable.
Revisit something that you said right there about the prefrontal cortex, because that's really important. I think I recently learned that it's not fully developed until like now. There's like new studies showing like 27, maybe it is.
Yeah, I've heard 25 for females, 30 for males.
That makes sense.
Males are slower. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's so long.
That really helped me when I had someone tell us, like, you need to be your teen's coach because they still don't have guide and encourage. But I had never heard that it wasn't something that even began to develop until 7. So that's new information for me.
Yeah. I mean, just physiologically, the studies they've done on the brain now, which is so helpful because this information, when we know that, then our expectations of our kids will be different. For a lot of us, once our kids start talking, we're thinking, okay, they're little adults. They get it. That's not the case at all. So there's a range and it depends on every child's brain is a little bit different, the environment they're raised in, but around 7 to 12 is when it starts coming online, when it starts forming, when they can start to see the prefrontal cortex area of the brain start to develop. And then it just slowly matures as they grow. But it matures differently than we physically mature. Physically, it's inevitable. We have a child. Every year, they're going to get older. They're going to go through puberty. Unless there's something physiologically at play, we can't stop that train. But emotionally and with the prefrontal cortex, it's not quite the same. So it starts coming on 7 to 12, but they've done studies now with young men in juvenile delinquent halls, and their prefrontal cortexes, almost without exception, is not developed. Like if you were to compare it to another 15-year-old that's more typical and doing well in school, their prefrontal cortexes are not the same. The young man in the juvenile hall who has been detained is typically underdeveloped. And what they're finding now is it's the environment that child was raised in. There's different reasons, but like either they weren't allowed to feel emotions, it wasn't safe to be expressing themselves. There was a lot of anger. There were things going on that didn't allow them to have the emotional maturity that needed to happen and the emotional experiences that needed to happen for the prefrontal cortex to develop in a way that they would traditionally see it. And so it's not the end for those young men. They found that they can put them in situations where they can intentionally help them develop that emotional capacity and their prefrontal cortex will develop. But unlike physical maturity, which is inevitable, the emotional maturity, which includes the development of the prefrontal cortex, it's spontaneous, but not inevitable. If we don't have the right conditions, it can be delayed. And so it's just really good information for us to know that it takes time and the right kind of experiences.
It's a cautionary tale too. As parents have a lot of power, we can suppress the development of the frontal cortex. That's pretty powerful to understand.
And yeah. What is it responsible for? Can you explain that a little bit to us as well?
Prefrontal cortex is one of the things that sets us apart from other mammals. So it allows us to think about our thinking, logic and reason, rational awareness, a lot of the thinking that we associate with being more mature, being more of an adult comes along because that prefrontal cortex is starting to come online. So being able to feel our emotions is a great example. So animals have emotions, which is the chemical reaction to things that are going on in their head and how they're processing situations. But feeling an emotion is more of a cognitive experience, giving myself the ability to process, oh, I'm feeling anger right now, or I'm feeling frustration right now. Let me process where that's coming from. Let me understand where that's coming from. Let me allow that emotion to be inside of me and go from frustrated or mad, surrendering or sad. That's all the function of the prefrontal cortex. So it's a really powerful part of our brain. I'm really grateful for it, but it's just nice to understand it a little bit more so that we don't assume our four-year-old has that fully functioning and that we hold them accountable. You told me you wouldn't do this again. They can't think from day to day the way we do. They don't understand cause and effect the same way we do. So it's not that we don't help them see, like, it's good to set intentions, it's good to follow rules, but the expectation is different of how we expect them to actually do that. So, yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. Where can people learn more about you, Andy?
Yeah, they can check out my book on Amazon or Audible, Connect Method Parenting. My website is the same name. I try to keep things really simple, connectmethodparenting.com. I have a free course people can go through that will take them through the high levels of it. And then my Instagram is just my name, Andy Martineau. So those are the best places.
Well, good. Well, I definitely think people will be looking up. I learned a lot on the frontal cortex. It's like, wow. We can suppress or help develop.
And yeah.
It's great power, great responsibility.
In your book, do you talk about activities to help encourage the development of the prefrontal cortex?
Yeah, I talk about how to promote emotional well-being and intelligence. And I don't necessarily call it out, like, do these exercises to enhance the prefrontal cortex, but really that's what it's doing. That's one of the really beautiful ways as parents we can help our children grow emotionally, develop that prefrontal cortex is by providing safety and helping our children have a safe place to really feel and experience all the emotions they're going through. So it's trickled throughout the whole book.
And Andy, do you see as parents respond opposed to react and are creating these safer spaces, are the children magically better? Like, wow, it's amazing. I'm better and now they're better. Do you hear a lot of that from people who follow your method that they're like, wow, this is so much easier than I was making it?
Yeah, a lot of parents have said exactly what you said to me. The thing that's interesting to note is sometimes it just takes longer than we think it's going to take. It's a whole body way of parenting. And so it's like the difference between going to a regular doctor, maybe you have a rash and they just give you an ointment versus a functional medical doctor who might still give you the ointment, but it's also going to say, okay, what's causing this? Maybe is there something internally? And so we are coming at it from all angles. And so it makes a difference in how the parent shows up, which makes a difference in how the kids are being able to interact in their environment. And there is a trickle effect. And sometimes it's super fast and I love it when that happens because that's so fun. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time for the child to say, okay, is mom for real? Can I really put my defenses down and trust that she's not just trying to get me to do something? But inevitably, if they stick with it, it makes a huge difference in the relationship and in the parent's ability to stay calm and connected and confident, no matter what those kiddos are doing.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Andy, and helping us understand how important connection and safety and trust is in all relationships, but especially in that primary relationship with our children.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining the 18 Summers podcast and putting your family in priority position. Subscribe and leave a review and help other families just like you.